Sorry, we gotta get away real quick. And the second answer was arc tan of x plus log of 1 plus x squared times a half. Yes, it should be returned in section tomorrow. So on the first question, pretty much everybody knew how to do that, so I won't do anything more. On the second question, the trick was that you write the integral as 1 over 1 plus x squared plus x over x plus 2. Sorry, 1 over x squared plus 1 plus x over x squared plus 1. If you divide it up like that, then it was easy. If you didn't do that, then it became impossibly difficult. Yes?
Can you repeat the answer on that?
Sure. So the first question was 29. And for the second question, which was integral x plus 1 over x squared plus 1 dx, the answer was 1 half log absolute value 1 plus x squared plus tan inverse of x plus a constant. Unless I'm misremembering what I just wrote down. Yes?
Can you get rid of the absolute value?
Yeah, because it's positive, you can get rid of it. It's completely equal to remove the absolute values. Because 1 plus x squared is always positive. Okay. In order to get your quiz back, you should go to section. The quizzes will be returned at section.
So how much did you lose if you forgot the quiz?
I don't know. Sorry. I hope you didn't do this.
Well, they did. That's all they did.
What we'll do today is I'll tell you about another physical interpretation of integration, namely as the average value of a function. For example, maybe the average temperature of a cup of soy latte, or the average speed at which you drive your car or something over some amount of time. So that will be the first part. Then I'll talk a little bit about polar coordinates. I'll remind you what they are and how to go back and forth between polar coordinates and rectangular coordinates. And I'll discuss how to draw graphs of equations that are given in polar coordinates. Next time we'll start talking about how to find the area of a region which is described in polar coordinates. Sometimes problems become vastly simpler if they're described in polar coordinates. So it's useful to know about them. All right, so we'll get started today with section 6.5 in the book on average values. Polar coordinates is in section 10.3. You might wonder why we've suddenly skipped from section 6.5 all the way to section 10.3. And the reason is because we're going to deal a little bit with complex numbers and polar coordinates. And both complex numbers and polar coordinates will allow us to understand complex exponentiation, that is, e to the power of a complex number. This will turn out to make it much easier to understand integrals involving trigonometric functions. They're much easier to sort of get your head around if you understand complex exponentiation. So the reason to skip from section 6.5 up to section 10.3 here is so that you can learn some things about complex numbers. Then we're going to come back to chapter 7 after you learn these things, and then we'll continue with integration techniques. But you'll have a much more powerful method, or at least a more conceptual method than the one that's given in the book, which is part of the supplemental notes. Okay, so on to section 6.5, the average value. So you might remember the usual notion of average. If you have a bunch of numbers, y1 through yn, their average is just the sum divided by the number of numbers. So my y sub average, it's y1 plus lambda plus yn, divided by the number of numbers here, which is n. So that's the average of a finite collection of numbers. You can think about this almost as a function. For each integer between 1 and n, you have a number, y sub 1, y sub 2, and so on. And this is the average of that. There's also a notion, as we'll see in a moment, that naturally extends this, of the average of a function, a continuous function on an interval over that interval. So let me show you the definition, and then I'll motivate why this is a reasonable definition and why it extends this usual notion of average that you already know about. This is also called the mean. Just quickly tell you that so you don't get confused. They're synonyms, mean and average. Okay, so here's a definition of the average value of a function. Let's tell you what it is right off. So what you have is a function f, it's a continuous function, we'll call it f of x, continuous on a closed interval from a to b. And here's the average value. So the average value of a function on the interval from a to b is 1 divided by b minus a, that's the length of the interval, times the integral from a to b of f of x dx. So remember, the integral is somehow like a generalized notion of a sum. This is the sum of the values divided by the number of them. So this generalizes, just heuristically at least, the usual notion of average. Now let me show you a more precise way in which these two are connected. So let's suppose we take our function, which, maybe here's the graph, from a to b, and we'd like to understand something about the average value that it takes on. And if you didn't know anything about calculus, you might, well, kind of get, you might think, well, okay, it's going to be very hard to figure out. Let's say this is a graph that gives the exact temperature of the cup of chai that I just bought. As I heated it up, it got really hot, and then as I drank it, it started getting colder, etc. So it's a nice, it's a continuous function. It might be hard to figure out the exact average value of this, but at least you could, using a thermometer, find out the temperature at a couple of discrete points. So a couple of specific points. You can measure the temperature of your cup of tea and get an approximation for the true average value of the temperature of the cup from time A to time B. So an approximation for the average is the 1 over the number of points at which you sample times the sum as I goes from 1 to n of, let's say this function is f of x, of f of x I. So that doesn't quite look like a Riemann sum. Remember, with the Riemann sum, there wasn't anything out here, but you multiply by this delta x. On the other hand, well, it's pretty close to looking like a Riemann sum. All you have to do is just do a little tiny bit of manipulation that will suddenly discover a Riemann sum, and then we'll know that there's a connection with integration. So here's the manipulation. Watch. So I'll just take this and multiply the top and the bottom right here by b minus a. So I'm doing very little. Okay, no problems there. Now what is the length, if I subdivide, if these intervals are all the same length, let's say these are all the same, they're all length delta x, what is delta x in terms of a, b, and n?
B minus a divided by n.
What do you think it is? Got your hand up. 7.
B minus a divided by n.
Excellent, you're right, and you're right. Very good. So it's b minus a over n. So look, here's the delta x. So it just pops right out. So I have 1 over b minus a times sum I equals 1 to n f of xi delta x. Does that look familiar to you? It's just a Riemann sum. For any value of n at all, this approximation is 1 over b minus a times the Riemann sum that you use to approximate the interval. So these approximations, if you consider the limit as n goes to infinity, the approximations converge to 1 over b minus a times the integral from a to b of f of x dx. Okay, so that's why this is the right mean, or the right definition, for the average value of the function. It's simply the average that you would get if you were to, or it's simply the limit of the averages that you would get by subdividing into smaller and smaller intervals and then computing the averages at your sample points. And we know that because of what I just showed you. Any questions? All right, let's do an example. I'll find the average of sine of x on the interval from 0 to pi. It's by definition 1 over pi minus 0 times the integral from 0 to pi sine of x dx. And now compute, and you get 1 over pi, and the antiderivative is minus cosine of x, 0 to pi, 1 over pi, and then the side here, evaluated at, or cosine of pi is minus 1, so you have minus, minus 1, minus, minus whatever you get when you evaluate at 0, which is 1. So here you have 1 plus 1, which is 2, so the result is 2 over pi. That's the average value that the sine function takes on between 0 and pi. Let me show you a graph that might give you further intuition for this. Thank you. Here's a graph of y equals sine of x between 0 and pi. Now I'll draw a graph of 2 over pi, something like this. Y is always equal to 2 over pi. My graph isn't perfectly to scale, but notice that if you take the average value, which is a single number, just the number that's defined by this formula, and multiply it by b minus a, that is the width, if you take the average value, which is how high the line is, and multiply it by the width, on the one hand, you're computing the area of the rectangle given there. On the other hand, you're computing this thing times b minus a, which is just the integral, which is the area under the curve. So the average value, it's the height that you have to draw a line so that the area under that rectangle is the same as the area of the entire, underneath the entire curve. You can see that my picture isn't quite to scale because it should be that if you take these two extra pieces, that should be just enough to compensate for the top. It's not quite to scale, but it's pretty close. So that's the average value. There really isn't much there. It's just another way to think about what integrals tell you. If you take an integral of some function and integrate it from one point to another, you get a number. What meaning might that number have? And you can interpret it as being the average value that the function takes on multiplied by the length of the interval over which you integrate it. And this business right here is supposed to, from first principles, have convinced you that what I just said is a reasonable physical interpretation of the integral. So here's another quick summary of everything I've said so far today. If you have a car and you drive somewhere, and then you drive back, and you drive somewhere else, then you stop and look at your odometer and see how far the total amount of distance you've gone is. What have you just found? You found the integral of the absolute value of your velocity, or the integral of your speed. If you divide that by the amount of time you traveled, what number do you get? If you take the total distance you traveled on your trip and then divide it by the time that you traveled, what number is that?
Average mile. What is it? Average mile power.
Something simpler. Just think, totally very elementary. You drive somewhere, you come home, you know, it took you 3 hours, you ended up driving a total of 100 miles. If you take 100 miles and divide it by 3 hours, what are you getting? Yeah, you're getting miles per hour. It's your average speed that you drove on the trip. And that's all I've been telling you today. I'm just giving you a description. I'm convincing you that that's true. That's all. Okay? So, and this is one example. So it's really not much to the average value thing. It's just the fact that the total distance you went divided by the amount of time is the average speed that you drove at. That's all this is. Okay, any questions? Any questions at all? Okay. All right, so now we're on to polar coordinates. We're taking a big jump all the way to section 10.3. Oh, I should state one thing really quickly. There's something called the mean value theorem. It simply says that if you have some function on an interval, it takes on the average value somewhere in that interval. There's some number between a and b where it actually takes on exactly that average value. So for example, if you drove all over the place and your average speed was 46 miles per hour in driving to LA and back, at some point, you are going exactly 46 miles per hour. That's all. Like, maybe when you're starting out, there wasn't so much traffic, so you went faster, and then you slowed down again. But at some point, your speed will exactly equal the average value. It's a consequence of the mean value theorem for derivatives. And the formal proof is a tiny bit of work. If you want to read it, I typed it up for the notes. And you can look at it there. All right, on to polar coordinates. So who here remembers anything about polar coordinates from like previous classes? All right, I'm gonna assume you don't remember anything then, because very few people raised their hands. That's okay. So polar coordinates are an alternative to the usual rectangular coordinates that you're used to using. So frequently, when you think about the plane, you think about a point as being given by or described by a pair of x comma y, and this is in rectangular coordinates. Here, this point is at the position x, y. It means it's over x units to the right and up y units. So that's a nice way to describe points, and it's useful in a lot of contexts. But sometimes there are situations that are much more easily described in using a different way of describing your location. For example, people typically, this is a little bit different, but people typically give points on the Earth by giving longitude and latitude. They don't give you an x and y coordinate, except maybe within a town where they tell you to go 35th Street to 4th Avenue. But globally, people typically give positions on the Earth, like if you look at your GPS receiver or something, it gives you the latitude and the longitude. And that's totally different than rectangular coordinates. Polar coordinates aren't exactly like that, but there's some relation at least. Okay, so what are polar coordinates? It's just a different way of describing a point. And here's the precise way in which you do it. So a point x, y corresponds to, you can give it by giving, in this other form, you can give an angle and a distance from the origin. So this is still in rectangular coordinates, but I've just written x and y in a slightly different way. Given any numbers x and y, you can always find a number r at an angle theta, so that x is r cos theta and y is r sine theta. The reason is just goes back to the definition of cosine and sine. So if this is r, then, and this is theta, then cosine of theta is equal to x over r. And sine of theta, just from the very definition of the sine function, is y over r. Okay, so here all I've done is written down the very definition of sine and cosine. This is how you define sine and cosine, as the ratio. The cosine is the ratio of this side to that side, the right triangle, and sine of this angle is the ratio of the opposite to the hypotenuse. Okay? So, any point in the plane can alternatively be specified by giving an r and a theta, by giving a distance this way and an angle. So you choose a distance and an angle, and that specifies a point. So instead of giving pairs x, y, you can give an r and a theta. These together will determine a point in the plane. And that's polar coordinates. It's a way of giving points in the plane. It's a little bit different than what you're used to giving. You give a point by giving an angle and a distance to go in that direction. So, unfortunately, the book uses exactly the same notation for polar and rectangular coordinates, a pair like this, but I guess I'll stick with that, but it's very confusing, I think. But it's usually explicitly said in the exercise what's meant. But the point is just that you can give a point in the plane by giving a distance and an angle. So then there are a couple of things that come up now that you have this alternative way of describing the plane in the plane. One is, given a point describing polar coordinates, that is by giving an r and a theta, how can you give back a point in rectangular coordinates? Two, given a point in rectangular coordinates, how can you get a point in polar coordinates? How can you get an r and a theta that represent that same point? Another serious issue that isn't a problem at all with rectangular coordinates is that the representation of a point in polar coordinates isn't necessarily unique. There can be different choices of r and theta that give you exactly the same points in the plane. And in fact, about half the homework problems seem to be about this non-uniqueness. So I'll tell you the various ways in which it's a problem. So here, there's exactly one pair of xy to represent any point, but here, in polar coordinates, there are lots of different ways. So the representation of a point in polar coordinates is very much not unique. So I'm going to spend the rest of today talking about ways in which this uniqueness can fail. And also, another thing that naturally comes up when you have polar coordinates is how can you draw a graph of an equation given in polar coordinates? We know a lot about drawing graphs of functions y equals f of x, or graphs of equations like x squared plus y squared equals 17. How do you draw the graph of a function of an equation given in polar coordinates, like r equals sine theta squared, something like that? Okay, first this non-uniqueness. But before we get going with non-uniqueness, let's just try to convert back and forth some points between polar and rectangular coordinates. Now, this gets kind of tricky if you want to write down the answers completely explicitly, because you have to know how to, you have to know all these formulas for, you know, what is the sine of pi over 3, that sort of thing. I'm not going to go into too much detail there. So I'm going to write down a point in rectangular coordinates. And let's see if somebody can give me the corresponding, or a choice of polar coordinates that represent exactly that same point. So what you have to do is give me, just to get you going, I'll show you how to do one of these. You have to give me an r and a theta. So given the point, you have to give a distance that you go from the origin and an angle at which you go it, and that will give you, or an angle at which you go, and that will describe a point. We want something that describes the same point. The point 1, 0, it's right here, say. Here, the angle is, or a choice of angle is 0, and a distance is 1. So 1, 0 is also, in this one particular case, the polar representation of this, This is also the polar representation of that point.
Do we have to put any units for the beta?
No. If you gave units for x and y somehow, then you would need units for r and theta. But I haven't introduced any units anywhere, so you don't have to worry about that. There could be units if that were part of the problem. But so far, all this discussion is unitless. Okay, let me do one that's more fun. So let's try 0, 1. Figure out what the polar coordinates are for the point who has x coordinate 0 and y coordinate 1.
0, 92, or pi. No.
Your guesses are converging.
0,
1. One of them was even right.
1 pi.
Yeah, 1 pi. 1 pi over 2.
Right, 1 comma pi over 2. Perfect. And somebody else said 90 degrees. I'm giving the, I'm just going to give them in, you know, radians, but 90 degrees of distance will be, would also be one. But it's better to use radians, because typically that's how sine and cosine are discussed. Okay, let's do another one. 0 minus 10.
Pi over 2
is straight up.
Oh, 3 pi over 4.
Wait, what did you say?
10
pi over
2.
Okay, let's see if that's. So it's 0, comma minus 10. And he says 10, 3 pi over 2. And that's right. So here, this point is down, minus 10. If you go all the way over to 3 pi over 2, that's down, and you go 10 in that direction. You could also, another right answer, completely the same point in polar coordinates. Yes, minus 10, pi over 2. If you point in the direction up and then walk backwards 10 meters, you end up at the same place as here. They're the same point. They just have different polar coordinate representations. So in a picture,
for the second one,
so our point's right here, 0 minus 10, and you can point up and then walk backwards 10 units and you'll lift it. So that's why this one is correct, r and theta. This one's correct because here, if you go to an angle of 3 pi over 2, sorry, chalk's in here. You go to an angle of 3 pi over 2, and then you walk down 10. It takes you to the same point. Can anybody think of yet another point, another pair, r theta, that represents this point?
Just keep on adding pi over 2.
That's right. You can have any multiple you want, any integer multiple you want, of pi over 2, and you get another point, where you get the same point, but with a different representation of polar coordinates. For example, minus 10, comma, pi over 2 plus 389 times 2 pi. You just put any number, any integer you want here, and you get the same thing. Doesn't make any difference. You end up getting the same point. If you were to go around and around and around and around completely 389 times and then go down, it wouldn't be any different. Okay, let's do another one that's maybe a little harder. Okay, what about 1 comma 1? What is this in polar coordinates?
The square root of 2 comma pi over 4.
Yeah, that's right. Square root of 2 comma pi over 4. Because here, for this example, the points right here are 1 comma 1. And you just have to figure out what the distance is from the origin. That's the square root of the sum of the squares of these two. That's square root of 2. And that gives you the r, or a trace of r. Notice that there's a sign ambiguity in r. You could choose an r that's positive at this angle, or a negative r that's that angle. So you can choose, your r can have either negative or positive sign, that's fine. And then the direction is pi over 4 again, this one. So that's right. What about 0 comma 0? What's a polar representation for that point? Let's say polar representation for 0, 0. 0, comma 59. 0, comma 59. Sure, that's right. 32, 59, they're all true. Any 0, comma anything at all works. Excellent.
Can I do 0?
What?
0 pi.
0 pi.
0 pi
would also be a representation. 0 anything works. Because it doesn't matter, I mean, it's the point of the origin, so it doesn't matter what angle. If you stand in any direction and don't move at all, you end up at the origin. What about the other direction? I can give you a point in polar coordinates, and then maybe you can figure out the rectangular coordinates. So let's say the point is 2, comma, pi over 4. What point does that represent, but in rectangular coordinates?
Pi over 2,
I'm thinking about that. Square root of 2. What everybody think about it? So what point is this in rectangular coordinates? All you have to do is use this. It's really easy, actually, to go in this direction. All you do is plug it into this formula. The r is 2. Yeah, good. So here it being healed out. Yeah, excellent. That's what it is. So. So you can use this formula. You can also just draw a picture. It's. You have a triangle with, this side is 2, that's pi over 4, so it's a right triangle, and let's see, these two sides are the same, because it's a 45 degree angle, so you can just figure out what they have to be. Let's see, so these both have to be root 2 in order for the sum of the squares of these two sides to equal 4. Okay? So that's it. Now you know how to convert back and forth. Final thing that you need to know how to do is how to draw a graph of an equation given in polar coordinates. By the way, I personally learned about polar coordinates first when I was doing a lot of video game programming when I was a kid, because it's incredibly useful to, very often when you have some, like, I don't know, alien attacking something and it's coming in a circular manner, spinning around you or something, amazingly often it's useful to represent things using these coordinates. Also, if you just want to make cool computer graphics demos with things, you know, moving around in neat ways, polar coordinates give you all kinds of really cool patterns that kind of, you know, you just, you just run through various values of r and theta in some sensible way, you can get some really neat-looking spiral graphs and things like that. So I used to play around with these a lot when I was a kid. Okay, finally, graphing an equation given in polar coordinates. So if you have some formula or some equation, like I think the example I wrote down was r equals sine theta. Yeah, r equals sine theta. You can draw a graph of it. You can draw a graph that represents all points in the plane that have r equal to sine of theta. Okay? There are many ways in which to try to do this. One pretty naive way is to make a table kind of like what we made over here, where you choose lots and lots of different values for theta, compute r, and then draw a graph. So for various values of theta, you've chose various angles and you know how far out you are. So for example, if theta is equal to 0, what is r? It's
0.
It's 0. Sine of 0 is 0. So we know this point right here is on our graph. If theta is pi over 4, so right here, what is r? How far do you go out to draw the point? Root 2 over 2. Good. So I guess root 2 over 2, let's just say it's here. So that's a point on the curve. The graph of this does look like a curve. It kind of goes like that. As theta gets bigger, at least up to here, this is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So this is theta equals pi over 4. And what about at pi over 2? What is r equal to? What is sine of pi over 2? 1. So when you go straight up, it's 1, which is a little bit less than that. So actually, if you keep going around, you see that the graph looks like a circle that's sitting on the x-axis. And again, what I've just done is, just for lots and lots and lots of different points, for lots and lots of different angles, I've figured out how far this r is. So if r equals sine theta, for any angle, I know what the point is. It's r comma sine theta. So the angle is sine, I mean, sorry, it's not r comma sine theta, but it's just in polar coordinates, it's the point r theta, where r is equal to sine theta. So it's this point. These are equal. So for each choice of theta, I get some distance from the origin, and I just draw those distances. And this function is giving me those distances from the origin in a given direction. It's kind of like when you draw a graph y equals f of x. For each value of x, you get a height. When you draw a polar graph, at least of the form r equals some function of theta, for each angle, you get a distance from the origin. You can imagine how it would be easy to make a spiral, for example. You would make the function that gives the distance from the origin get smaller and smaller and smaller as a function of the angle. You would get a spiral. Because you go around, and as you went around and around and around, it would get smaller and smaller and smaller. That doesn't happen here, though. This function, sine of theta, it just oscillates. It starts out at 0, it goes up here, and then it goes to 1, and it goes back to 0, and it just keeps going around and around. So this actually, if you just graph lots and lots of values of theta, just gives you a circle. But it's pretty hard to see just from plugging in points that you're actually getting a circle. There's a much better way to see what you're really getting in this case. So here's what I'll do. I'll just substitute, though with a little bit of cleverness, I'll substitute what r and theta, well, what x and y are in terms of r and theta, and that will allow me to figure out, well, I'll find a graph just involving x and y that will turn out to be a circle, and then I'll know this movie is a circle. So what are r and theta in terms of x and, what are x and y in terms of r and theta? That will make it a lot easier to do this. So one thing is x and y are given right here. This is x, and this is y. But it's useful to have some slightly easier to work with formulas. So here's something that's worth noticing. X squared plus y squared is equal to r squared times sine squared theta plus cos squared theta. But sine squared plus cosine squared is just equal to 1, so this is equal to r squared. So you have this relation between x, y, and r squared, at least. X squared plus y squared is r squared. Or square root of x squared plus y squared is r, at least up to sine. So if we have an equation and we have an r squared, then you can replace r squared by x squared plus y squared because of this. You can also solve by theta. Theta is tan inverse of y over x, just because tan theta is y over x. So these two formulas give you a way to go from an equation involving r and theta to an equation involving just x and y. It would be better to write it over tan inverse y over x equals theta. See, what you could do is everywhere where you see a theta, just replace it by tan inverse of y over x. Everywhere where you see an r, replace it by plus or minus squared of x squared plus y squared. Of course, you're going to run this mess if you just directly do that. If you did that over there, you'd end up with sine of arctangent of y over x. It gets very messy. So you have to be a little bit more careful and try to avoid just directly doing the substitution. But look what happens if you take this equation. Here's a very simple observation that you get to use over and over again. Just replace this by multiply both sides by r. You get r times r equals r sine theta. That is r squared is equal to r sine theta. Now, r squared is just x squared plus y squared. And r sine theta is what? What is that in terms of x and y?
Y.
You're right, it's y. So x squared plus y squared equals y. That's the completely equivalent equation. X squared plus y squared equals y. And now you can, just by completing the square, you can write this as, you know, like a usual equation for a circle that's been translated. And you'll end up getting this. So let's do that. Let's complete the square. So we'll take this and now subtract off a y from both sides. So it's x squared plus y squared minus y equals 0. Now I'm going to complete the square. I'll write this as x squared plus put something there so that I get a perfect square and so that the coefficient here matches up. So I think I want to put 1/2, but then I get an extra 1/4, so I have to put that over here. So look at this. This is the equation of a circle of radius 1/2. Remember, this is a point, 0.10. So this is in fact 1/2. So it's a circle of radius 1/2 centered at 0, 1/2, which is this point right here. So we've just, by converting this function in polar coordinates to a function in rectangular coordinates, by converting this equation in polar coordinates to an equation in rectangular coordinates, we figured out for sure, not just by plugging in points, that this really is the graph of a circle. One of your homework problems, the last one in this section, is to take a general equation of the form r equals A sine theta plus B cos theta, and prove, simply by mimicking what I've done here, that the graph of that is a circle, and what you'll do is you'll figure out where the center of the circle is and what the radius of the circle is in terms of A and B and R, or actually just in terms of A and B. So what I just did right here is a special case when A is equal to 1 and B is equal to 0. But you could write down all kinds of things. So if you maybe you should look in your book, but there are a whole bunch of graphs in there, and you'll do some in your homework, where if you just you start writing these down, you end up getting all kinds of neat pictures that look like you get things that look like this, you get spiral out, you can get pictures that maybe look like that, kind of go back and forth. So all kinds of really, really neat graphs that you get of these functions given in polar coordinates. All right, so we have 6 minutes left, and I'd like you, again, like you did once before for me, to take out a piece of paper and write what you found clear and what you found incredibly confusing about today's lecture, and any comments or advice you have for the class to improve it. And then just leave, this is totally anonymous, but greatly appreciated by me. Yes? Sorry, it's for you. All I did was take this equation and multiply both sides by R. It's just a trick. It's a surprising trick, now that you've seen it. That's it. It's really, isn't that cool? Because if you directly plug in the data in R, you get a total disaster. But if you multiply both sides by R, you get a really easy one. It's a totally cool trick. I thought about you having too many different things that you want to do, just do them all. That's like, and like, just whatever pays off, you're lucky.
This will probably be a whole lot easier once I get an ID card and I can use the university library rather than trying to rely on the disorganized drafts of information on the internet.
Cool. Do you have a library card?
I think I'm going to get one real soon now.
Why is it taking so long? Bureaucracy.
What?
Why is it taking so long?
Because I'm just going into this one class.